Hello and welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast by Bald Move. We're the officially unofficial podcast for all things concerning HBO's Game of Thrones. I'm your host, Aaron, and joining me is...
Anthony.
And like we did last year, we are back to kind of prime the Game of Thrones pump, and we're here to talk about our new book, Gods of Thrones. Last year, we released Volume 1 because of the incredible generosity and response to our Kickstarter. One of the stretch goals was to produce a Volume 2.
We have actually done that.
We have produced the second volume, and there's lots of cool topics that we didn't get to touch on. Obviously, in the first book, we are covering the, among others, the religion of the Faceless Men, the Drowned God's religion, the Targaryen dragon cult,
the Dothraki. The Lazar religion.
Yeah, the Steppes Plains people of Essos.
We revisit the religions of the North and ask, is Bran a god?
Is Bran a god? And we are going to be talking about some of those topics this week. We're going to be talking about how the Targaryens' policy of incest drove their militarism and their need to conquer Westeros. We're going to be talking about how... Danny engaged in a little bit of horse trading when it came to Dario Naharis. And then we're going to have a segment we call Fun with Names, because there's lots of fun names and they're fun to say and they're fun to hear. And we're going to say them and you're going to presumably listen to it. So we have made Volume 2. It is now available on pre-sale. If you go to Amazon.com, there's a link to it in the show notes to our product page. You can actually pre-order Volume 2, so you'll get it the moment it is released. We are, unlike last time, going to have a simultaneous print and ebook campaign. So if you have a Kindle, you're great. If you want to see a Dead Weirwood Tree production, we've got you covered there. Please pre-order a book now. Its release date is the 9th, which corresponds to our first Jim and Aaron official promo podcast for Game of Thrones Season 8. We did the trailer talk just a couple weeks ago. We're going to be doing 2 weeks of Gods of Thrones promotion and then get right into the season. So that's how you is. Have I left anything out, Anthony?
Well, if you enjoy some of the original illustrations by our magnificent artist, Chase Stone, you can go to godsofthrones.com. And purchase...
They cannot do that as of the time we're recording.
Oh, shit.
That's something we're going to be doing next week. That's next week promo.
All right.
But we do... that reminded me of... Oh, we probably need to give a Kickstarter update to, like... maybe I can go ahead and do that. If you were a Kickstarter supporter, the good news is you will get the rewards appropriate to your level. Like if you backed a physical copy of the book, you will get a physical copy of Volume 2, no extra charge. If you backed a ebook level, you'll get those ebooks sent out in the mail. Actually, you'll probably be getting those sooner rather than later, because those are going to be ready to go before, obviously, the print edition on Kindle or on Amazon's ready to go. And as well as, I know some people are waiting on the poster pack rewards. Those are going to go out now too, since we have all the art and we got a lot of cool new pieces. If nothing else, check out the product page just so you can see the cover, because Chase Stone, our artist, we commissioned him to do the first one. First cover is about the first men burning down the Weirwoods. This goes a little bit further back in time. And shows us the children actually carving their faces on the Weirwoods, and it's really stunning, spooky piece of art, if I do say so myself.
Indeed, yeah, he really outdid himself this time.
And there's lots of other cool art to check out as well. Again, go to the show notes of the podcast, and you can see you can pre-order that. You can preview the cover. You can see what some other religious scholars have said about Volume 2, and their recommendation for it. And, other than that, let's get into the meat of the podcast.
Let's do it.
Hey, I thought we could start a conversation, cause I've had the interesting prep for this podcast of essentially reading our book two or three times in the last few weeks, because, we're doing the final proofreading, and then we are doing the final copy, make sure everything is looking good as far as the copy editing and the formatting, typesetting. So I've been forced, quote unquote, forced to read.
We've unified. Yeah, we've now unified King's Landing. It is two words. There is an apostrophe.
And there's one that I thought was really an interesting point that you made, which is you're doing this. These books are all about comparative analysis of religions and Game of Thrones and the politics and cultures there. And you made a lot of interesting comparisons between the Targaryen dynasty and the Egyptian dynasties of antiquity.
Right.
And one of the things you point out is how important it was in breeding, keeping the bloodlines pure is important for lots of different political structures over history. We see this in lots of kings and queens where you'd marry cousins and stuff. Yeah. But like the Egyptians practice a very extreme form where like brother would be wed to sister for generations and generations.
Yeah.
And that was not perhaps ideal for a guy like King Tut, Tutankhamun. It seems like he had a lot of biological issues as a result of all that.
Yeah,
inbreeding.
You can actually look it up. They've done DNA study and determined that
the boy ain't right.
Yeah, he's probably the product of incest, and this is not uncommon.
Yeah, so. You mentioned that, and Fire and Blood makes us very clear how the Targaryens kind of came in with marrying brother and sister, and for several of the first generations, that they were all about that. They continued doing that mold, even when they're like, wow, this has really caused us a lot of grief with the common folk and with the new religion. They still couldn't say no to that sweet brother-sister marriage action.
Well, and it's part of the world-building stuff, because if indeed there is this belief or reality that keeping the bloodline pure will facilitate better control of their dragons, and basically the dragons are their lifeblood. They cannot exist without their dragons, because otherwise they're a pretty weak family, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you believe that in order to keep that connection strong, you have to keep the bloodlines pure, then you're going to want to make sure that you marry someone from the blood of Old Valyria, right?
Right. Well, and there's also that's the world building in here, but like in real life, they've got these, ruling class ideologies where it's like, why is the king ruling over us again? Oh, because he's just better. Why is he better? He has the royal blood. He has the blue blood.
He has magic blood.
That's literally what it is. And yes. Obviously, if you take that magic blood and you mingle it with some commoner blood, you're going to get you're going to get mud blood in there to go to Harry Potter terms. And then he might not be able to rule. So you want to keep that bloodline pure.
Yeah.
So the Targaryen's extreme practice of this blood purity actually might be one of the prime reasons that Aegon is remembered as a conqueror, because there's two ways you can gain lands and titles in a feudal system like Westeros. One, you can do it by conquest. The second is you can form marriage and political alliances through intermarriage.
Yeah, clearly the Targaryens, at least the first couple generations of Targaryens, are rejecting marriage offers from other noble families.
Mm-hmm.
So Aegon's getting peace treaties in the form of marriage offers from other noble families, but he's rejecting them. So if he wants to expand beyond Dragonstone, and he's not willing to marry into another tribe, then he's going to have to take it by force, right?
Right. He has to. There's no other way.
There's no other way. I mean, I guess he could be really nice, but that doesn't only get you land, right?
You could purchase, I suppose. It's the other, wealth, using that influence. But, imagine if he had married one sister to the Stormlands to consolidate that, and married another of his sisters to the Vale, and then he himself married one of the princesses from a third kingdom. you'd have half of Westeros sewn up just by default. And then you keep playing that politics and forcing the smaller kingdoms to get online, and you could conceivably unite Westeros through, I mean, that's kind of like the story of Western Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries, right? That these things were all like, that's one of the reasons World War One is kind of a family affair. Like literally every right. one of the major belligerents, the Kaiser, the king, the king, was the king of England? Yeah, king of England. The different Prussian and the Russian army, they were all led by essentially cousins. This is all just like a family squabble,
right? Right. But
Aegon did not do that because of their views on blood purity.
Yeah. And think about what are dragons good for? They're good for conquering.
Yes.
And they're good for as a symbol of power, right? So in the same way that we, you know, America has this nuclear arsenal, the threat of that arsenal allows America to deal from a position of power. Mm-hmm. So Aegon's sitting there thinking, why should I share my power with these, you know, people from the Crown Lands or the Neck or wherever, when I've got dragons and I will just take it. Right.
Yeah.
So if you're committed to marrying your sister, so you're not going to have an marriage alliance and you have dragons and you're committed to, you know, you using your dragons to great effect, it means that you're going to conquer. Yeah, that will facilitate a conquest.
So I was also curious with this hypothesis. I don't know how well you know your truly ancient Egyptian politics, but did some of those kingdoms have trouble with diplomacy because they were all about, you know, keeping it in the family?
So it's interesting because we're all with ancient history, we are always dealing with a combination of myth and history. And much like the Targaryens, there are exceptions to the rules when it comes to ethics, because if you do believe that the royal family has magic blood, then they are fundamentally different than commoners. And what we're talking about here is, in a sense, the pharaoh is a representative of the divine. So either the son of Ra or a god on earth or however you want to say
it. And that mirrors the Targaryens, because they believe that all of their gods' names were kind of, well, it's hard to say which came first, chicken and egg. They named all their dragons after after Valyrian gods,
right?
Implying that the dragons themselves were divine, and they themselves thought that they were also dragons in human form, that they themselves were divine. So the Targaryens did see themselves as something of at least demigods, if not full on gods themselves,
right? And even if they don't, they believe that the blood of the dragon runs through their veins, and so the rules for marriage are different for them than they are for other people. And same thing with Egyptians. The Egyptian pharaohs are really modeling themselves after gods who marry brother to sister. So the gods marry brother to sister, and then the pharaohs marry brother and sister. Not always, but sometimes. And again, we have a chicken and the egg thing, or what comes first, the myth that gods marry brother to sister, or the myth created to justify the pharaohs marrying brother to sister?
I also imagine it's kind of hard to say, because like Egypt is almost unimaginably ancient. One thing that the one stat that I read that's a true fact that blows my mind is that Cleopatra, who we already think of as like this ancient person, and who is in fact an ancient person, she's closer to the time of landing on the moon than she is to the time when the great pyramids of Giza were constructed.
That's crazy.
Can you fucking imagine? She's more contemporary to the moon landings than to the pyramids. So like to say that like Egypt did this or did that in diplomacy or warfare. It's like, what does that even mean to say this dynasty that's literally that, like these dynasties that are thousands of years old, you know?
It really does give you a sense of what the Chinese, what these Chinese dynasties were, because,
yes,
you know, I mean, let's put it this way. When I was living in England, I was living in this little garden cottage that was older than America.
Right.
It was just this little stone cottage.
Sure, sure.
And it was older than Thomas Jefferson. So, right. Yeah, it's we're very, very new on the scene. Mm-hmm. You know,
we still have the new country smell.
We really do.
Yeah.
And you know what? It could go away real fast.
Sure. Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
One thing I wanted, since we're talking about Targaryens, I wanted to talk about Dany's relationship with Daria.
Okay. Yeah, this is kind of an interesting, I guess, development or reversal of the stuff we're talking about.
So, first thing, obligatory, we need Aaron, we need you to explain Book Dario's visage.
So, Book Dario is... he's ridiculous looking by modern non-Westerosi standards. He has a forked beard that he's dyed this vivid blue. His hair is long and it is also dyed blue. He's got gold teeth. He's got this prominent kind of like hook nose. he kind of looks like a more extreme punk rock version of Johnny Depp from from the Pirates of the Caribbean. You know,
doesn't
gold,
he have
like,
a gold think, tooth? Did you already mention?
Yeah,
the
I said gold
tooth.
I think he also has like his mustachio is like twirled and braid, and it's got like so there's like gold adornments in there, and he's got these daggers and racks that have these golden naked women. Like in the book, I refer to him as like trucker mud flap women. And which was, I think, it's interesting out of all the extreme features of Dario that they choose to omit from, you know, translating him to screen. They keep the naked lady hand, they keep the trucker mud flap handles, everything else. Nah, we got, whether you prefer the Euro trash flavor of Dario or the sleek, sleepy Dario Naquilis version that was in season three on, they did tone him down. They did give him the real world, you know, boiled leather kind of treatment. Yeah.
Well, he's supposed to be, you're supposed to get the sense that he's a mimbo. He's a sexual object. And I don't think that if you brought book description Dario to the screen, he'd be viewed as a clown. He wouldn't be viewed as a sex object.
Although I don't, because like I said, I think that like when I was growing up, Axl Rose was very popular.
It's
and
true.
I always thought like, I don't understand what a woman would see in Axl Rose, but you know, I clearly was not a teenage girl during that time. And him, his
Axl Rose. What about like Billy Joel? I mean,
Billy Joel is a smoldering hunk of pure sex, and Christie Brinkley is not wrong in that respect.
Dude, if you're a rock star, it really doesn't matter what you, especially in the 80s
and that's,
and 90s.
So I think that's what you're supposed to understand is Dario Naharis is a rock star. Danny is literally a teenage girl, and she is completely, like, her mind is completely blown by, like, you know, her brother, was always tried to maintain and like posture the perfect Targaryen, you know, grooming and dress. And here's this rough and tumble dude to get shit done and very masculine. And anyway, we're running way far afield with our crushes on Dario Naharis here.
So all right. So one of the things that we talk about in the book that was interesting to both of us was how different Dany is as basically a sort of a slave bride at the beginning.
Right.
And what she becomes when she is, you know, going after Dario. So she really is in love with Drogo, right? Mm-hmm. But Drogo is, as far as his power in the relationship, he has almost all of the power in the relationship.
Right.
And she's got to try to figure out how to use sex to gain a little bit of power in that relationship. But when we end up meeting Dany in The Dance of Dragons, she has all of the power in the relationship with Dario.
Right.
So it's completely flipped. And it's almost like she is now in the position that Drogo was in that relationship. And Dario is basically her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So that interested me. And it also interested
some background that I thought was fascinating when you're making these points is that this is in a deep dive in like the Dothraki culture, because the Dothraki is prizes masculinity and the ability to ride a horse. And like essentially
to be a horseman means that you are the ideal male, and not being able to sit a horse means that you're something less than male, right?
Right. It's not even ideal male. Like, to be considered masculine in a Dothraki context, you had to be a rider. In fact, the word for Dothraki male implies that you're a rider. So if you were sick or too weak or whatever, you were not considered. So like, one of the things that the novels, and this is kind of largely absent of the Dario Naharis that we see in the show, but he's like a consummate horse rider. He is, and he's very powerful as a warrior. He's kind of like represents the ideal Dothraki masculine power.
Even though he's not Dothraki,
right?
He is a warrior. He's a sexual dynamo.
Mm-hmm. And to bang this point home, You pointed out that his last name's Naharis. Nahar is actually the name of Tolkien's horse god, one of the mighty you know, I guess Shadowfax is probably his great, 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 great grandson.
Right. So yeah, Nahar is the Tolkien horse deity. So Gorn himself is
making this connection. Yeah.
Yes. If you're going to create the ideal male from a Dothraki perspective, Naharis is exactly what you'd name him. And in the books, he brags, he brags about being able to ride faster than an arrow and whatever. And clearly the showrunners don't get this, because what they do is they have him say horses are stupid. And of course, that's a different character in the books. Anyway, here's the point.
The point is that he's a rock star. Yes. Dothraki horse god. Right. Sex horse god.
He's a sex horse god. So, yes. So Dany's really into the sex horse god, and but she takes hold of all of the power in the relationship, which is interesting to me because the progression of her character goes from someone who is basically traded like a horse to the horse people, and then as she accumulates power, she ends up taking power over the ideal Dothraki male. And so she ascends by demonstrating her power over Daario. And in the book, you don't find this in the show, but in the book, eventually Dany ends up trading Daario to the rulers of Yunkai as a hostage.
Right.
And so she does to Daario what was done to her. She was once traded as an object, and then she ends up taking the Dothraki male, the ideal Dothraki male, and trades him in a political maneuver.
Yeah, so he gets traded in a way to help her consolidate and keep her power in exactly the same way that her brother traded her as a favor to get.
She's become the horse trader.
Yeah. Which, that's super cool. And also, even like you point out in the book, and they do a pretty good job of showing this in the show, is that like all this relationship power is held by Dany. Like, she may be infatuated, she may even love him in some way, but she is capable of using him and discarding him when it's politically expedient. And I thought that was a pretty sweet little...
That's cool. And, you know, it's interesting because he is something of a one-dimensional character, but... Mm-hmm. He is a tool. He's like a literary tool to allow. He's like a rung on a ladder for Dany. Mm-hmm. You know, she has to ascend. Her character has to ascend. You know, to someone that you might consider like not just mother of dragons, but mother of Westeros. Right.
Right.
So Daario is kind of an important rung on the ladder for her.
So I thought those were some interesting points. The other thing that jumped out at me in this second volume of Gods of Thrones, is a little segment I like to call fun with names, because
we do have a lot of fun with names.
Yeah. And it's so funny because, I started thinking about this when I was doing True Detective, last month, in that, you know, it stars Mahershala Ali.
Yeah.
And I did not know this, but Mahershala's full name is like Mahershala Shala Hasbaz, which is a biblical, is like the long, it's famed as being the longest name in the Hebrew Bible.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. And I forget who this guy, I think he was like one of maybe the prophet Daniel's friends. Cause like,
wow.
There's a whole,
well, look, dude, you're showing me up, man.
No. Oh shit. But yeah, I also
I got no idea about this.
Right. Well, it's so like, but that's like, that's a name. That's a name that like gets up and put its pants on and strides out the door every morning. And there's a lot of these interesting names. I want to go through a few of them. So you're talking about in the book. So one of the chapters revolves around the Targaryens, and we've already talked about a lot of this and comparing them to Egyptian and other, like this cult of a dragon, like the fact that they consider themselves gods. You say that this isn't unprecedented in real life because this is an ancient Babylonian or Macedonian king, Marduk.
Or yeah, is this Babylonian like Marduk, and probably borrowing from earlier myths. But yeah, Marduk, in order to bring stability to creation, Marduk has to demonstrate power over chaos.
Uh-huh. And this chaos is represented by a dragon that he's taming. And we actually have a picture of this book of this relief, this bas relief sculpture, where it shows him with this dragon kind of like you know, like in a lap dog, not a lap dog, but like as a, like a, like a, like healing like a dog.
So yeah, he little, has this little thing. Dog dragon.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the dragons are all often, before they become kind of European greed monsters.
Right.
In ancient mythology, dragons almost always represent chaos. Mm-hmm. So the Marduk has to defeat a dragon named Mushushu. So that Mushushu. Mushushu uh-huh. is the chaos dragon, and once Marduk is defeats Mushushu, then Marduk can demonstrate that he's got a handle on the created order, and he keeps Mushushu as a pet to kind of like basically the dragon becomes a slave, right?
I think it's interesting too because, like, you mentioned that this is something you talk about in the book that, you know, chaos as humans conceive it religiously as a lot of times has connections like the water, the ocean,
right?
You know, the ocean is chaos, and then this comes from you know, if you're a land based mammal and you go out in the ocean, my God, your ships get beat to splinters and there's no control over it, and then dry
it's
land,
all fluid.
There's stability there, and that it's interesting that dragons like a worldwide phenomenon, but there's definitely a split where like the Asiatic dragons are more tend to be kind of neutral or even good blessings and good omens, whereas the European dragons are, as you say, the greed monsters. They're just powerful, destructive, borderline evil, chaos. And what's interesting is it's almost like those dragon identities split. Because you also point out that dragons in like China and other Asian cultures are associated with like water deities.
Yeah, they bring rain. They live underwater, so they'll live in the lake or they'll live in the river. Mm-hmm. And when they ascend to heaven, they'll bring the water with them so that it will rain. Mm-hmm. So dragons are the yin and tigers are the yang. And you do not want too much of one or the other. You want balance. You want to be right. able to have your crops watered. And so you will create these religious rituals around dragons to get the dragons to actually do their job.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that this ancient chaos dragon seems to be split, and that like the Eastern philosophies and religions kept the aspect of it tied to, like, you know, the water and chaos that way. But overall benevolent, because you need the dragons to go into the sky to bring the water with them so you can get rain. Where in Europe, it's the Western philosophies and religions conceived them as kept the chaos in like their personalities and their aspects and their power.
Well, consider living in England. You're living on a big island, right?
Right.
And so if you do
water,
have a
probably
myth,
not a, pro, also droughts and water probably not as big a problem as some of the more desert climes and
sure yeah. And you're going to end up, you know, if you're going to borrow the mythology of dragons, you're going to borrow in such a way that makes sense to your own culture.
All right, so that's Mushushu. You also mentioned that, you know, Aladdin, he of the thousand tales and the four and all that. In Disney, he's popularly seen as courting and winning the affections of a princess named Jasmine.
Yeah, it's a nice name, right?
It's a nice name. It's beautiful. Smells like it sounds like it's fragrant and smells very nice. But you mentioned that in the actual legend of Aladdin that he married a woman named I'll take a stab at it. Badroubledore.
Yeah, Badroubledore. Isn't that a beautiful name?
It is a lot of fun to say. It's very bouncy.
If you're looking for a name for your daughter, let's say you're expecting, consider Badroubledore.
What would be the short? What would you call it for short? Because you can't do bad.
Badass
dour,
mama.
Badass Badroubledore. And then I think you suggested another one for fun with names is a Pacific Island God.
Kumugwe. All right, now Kumugwe. I don't really know if I'm pronouncing this correctly. This is Lower Mainland, Canada, so Vancouver area. Kamugwe is, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but I know a lot about him.
Oh, so this isn't Pacific Islander. This is more First Nation.
God. This is First Nations. Yeah.
Okay. And then this is the interesting thing about him is usually underwater deities are like evil or.
Right. We bring this guy up in the Ironborn religion because the object of their veneration is an underwater deity.
Uh-huh.
Which is odd. Normally you worship the sky god and the underwater deity.
Right. Underwater is where all the chaos lives.
Yeah. You don't want chaos. So, but I love this guy because he lives underwater and he's awesome. Like, so I give a few facts about Kamugwe in the book. His head is as big as an island. He is the master of seals. His nemesis.
And that's like the flippers and balancing balls on the seals, not like, you know, wax or anything like that.
Or the singer.
The singer, right.
His nemesis is Tsekwame, who's a great bird that makes thunder with its wings and lightning with its eyes. Kamugwe controls the tides. He sees into the future. He has octopi bodyguard. So he's got this troop of octopi that serves as his bodyguard. He's wealthy beyond belief. He eats human eyeballs. And if you find him, he might give you magical powers or eat your eyeballs. And my favorite fact about him is that he resides in a house made of living sea lions.
Well, you know, it makes sense. He's the master of seals. If I was going to meet Kamugwe,
yeah,
and I wanted a magic powers and I don't want my eyeballs to be eaten, is there anything I should keep in mind? Does he like his belly rubbed? Does he? What kind of fragrant spice does he like to have as a burnt offering?
I would just be polite.
Be polite? All right.
Yeah.
So he also values manners. Yeah, that's sure. Cool. That's cool.
You can't buy him off. He's got all the money already, though.
That's true. Okay. We actually had a fair amount of feedback from the last time before we took our winter hiatus when we were still doing the Fire and Blood and Gods of Thrones promo for the first volume. So I thought before we got onto any new issues, and just obviously not any new issues until we start releasing the podcast again, we could go back and kind of bat cleanup. So these are emails that we got essentially last December, and we're going to consider them now. You can send feedback as always to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. You can also discuss this stuff with your fellow fans at our forums, forums.baldmove.com. All right, without further ado, Jordan W's up first. Says, I was just listening to the Start of Fire and Blood Part 3 podcast. I thought I'd weigh in about the state of the Night's Watch. You guys were discussing how the Night's Watch has declined so quickly and that it seems strange considering how many recruits they were receiving after each war. Anthony, I think, mentioned that it would only take one king not sending their enemies to the wall to mess the Night's Watch up. And my immediate thought was big old Bobby B. Robert fought in two wars in his life, and after each one didn't send very many, if any, in the case of the Greyjoy Rebellion, to the wall. When Jor Mormont is talking about the Watch, he refers to them as tired old men and green boys, as if there is a generation with very few people taking the black. Another thing that occurred to me is that before Robert, we had the Mad King that wouldn't send traitors to the wall because he'd preferentially burn them. Between the two of them, it's a long time since the Night's Watch had a large influx of recruits like they got at the end of Dance of Dragons. Yeah, so this is Bobby B was famous for being very lenient to his foes and pardoning them of their crimes. And essentially the only ones that like ended up at the wall were people like Alistair Thorne, who were too proud to like essentially ask for the pardon or admit the guilt, you know. So you've got a king, and I think that his logic tracks here, Anthony, that you've got a king and the Mad King Aerys who was burning his enemies and not allowing them to take the black, and you've got Bobby B who was just allowing them to resume their old posts and lands and titles if they would just, you know, kneel, not forcing a bunch of people to take the black. Because one thing in Fire and Blood is, you know, there was times where the wall would swell. Like, yeah. You'd have thousands of people sent there because every minor lord that turned the hand against the king or was involved in a Blackfyre rebellion or a Dance of Dragons, you know, would either be executed or sent to the wall. this does so kind of match.
What would be the period? All right, so let's imagine it's about a 30-year period. If you just took the reign of right. of the Mad King and then Bobby B,
right?
How many years is that?
Between Mad King and it's like 20 years, right? Long enough for Ned to have a couple kids and one of them to be like 16.
Right. So let's just say that you've got a 20-year period where no one's going, you know, very few people are going to the wall.
Right. Other than like common condemned criminals, you know.
And the average lifespan's about, you know, 45 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like what Mormont says, we've got, you know, old men and green boys. You're missing a generation there.
No, I like it. Makes sense.
Yeah.
And also because like if the other thing Fire and Blood makes clear is like at the beginning of the Targaryen dynasty, the Night's Watch is fine. They're still garrisoning all their castles. They're still like occupying the Night Fort, although they did mention that the Night Fort was so big and disrepaired because the Night's Watch wasn't as formidable as they used to be. But they're not like where they are in the Baratheon period, where they're down to essentially the three most important castles and very poorly manned at that. They can't afford to keep the haunted forest cut back like they should.
Right.
And they're, you know, like letting regular wilding patrols that have the tenacity.
So this is interesting. So a lot of fans like to talk about why didn't the White Walkers emerge sooner?
Yeah.
You know, they've been up there for thousands of years or whatever. Right.
Right.
So, why now? Well, I guess one way to look at it would be like, well, the human sacrifice with Craster kind of mm-hmm. stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Another way to look at it would be the White Walkers are just paying attention and they're realizing that the Night's Watch is, you know, these castles are falling into disarray. The Night's Watch is dwindled. If ever they're going to make a move, this is the time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could just be like it's the timing thing is dictated simply because
it's opportunistic.
Oh yeah, the Night's Watch is just really weak.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it has nothing to do with Craster. I don't know.
Let's move on to Caitlin H, who says, "I'm just listening to your God of Thrones episode about Catelyn." Caitlin's wanting to talk about Catelyn. And you guys have discussed the role of Lady Stoneheart in the books as well as her interaction with Brienne. I wanted to throw a thought into the mix because I love where the discussion is going, but I have an alternate idea about what happens with her. First, though, I want to say that I think Lady Stoneheart may not be Arya's redemption because I think that will be Gendry and possibly Nymeria. I know probably not, but I'm hopeful. Actually, there's a... You make an interesting point in the book about how Nymeria might... Like, the fact that she was introduced... Actually, no, this wasn't you. This was Alt-Shift-X. Alt-Shift-X on his video doing the trailer breakdown kind of made the point out that, you know, why would you establish Nymeria after everyone has essentially forgotten her last episode? Yeah, it's a nice grace note for Arya, but would be super fucking badass if, like, an army of wolves led by a dire wolf features prominently in, like, the Battle of Winterfell or something like that. Like, it's not even... It's not even a force that's directly controlled by the humans. It's just human. It's just human allied and adjacent. So anyway, you might if Alt Shift X is on your side.
In that
Caitlin.
Video, he kind of slows it down and says, uh-huh. "Look in between these hoof hooves."
Oh, there's also
It
some
looks like there's a wolf. There's a wolf there, and
which,
you know what?
You know, we have
part
ghost.
Of me thinks you know the double D's. It's not like they're immune to hearing fan complaints. They know that we want direwolves.
And they're
right?
they kind of almost over-responsive to some
things. They almost owe us. They owe us.
Yeah.
So it could be one of those things like, yeah, we're going to give them to you, but we need to – you can't look at them every scene or else it won't be thrilling.
Right.
When we reveal them in the penultimate episode or whatever it is.
They want to see tears of joy running down our nerd cheeks when the direwolves finally take the battlefield. All right, so back to Caitlin. She says, "My hope for Lady Stoneheart is that she and Bran run into each other in some way, and Bran is able to reassure her that the girls are alive through his voodoo knowledge, and she's finally able to rest." Back to Brienne. Anthony was just stating on the pod that if anyone values honor and their word in this world, it's Brienne. You both have agreed that you think a single word Brienne says is sword. This is referring to the... the final. Well, I guess not final, because we actually get with Brienne before the end of the books. But Lady Stoner has captured her, and she's given her a choice about whether she's going to accept her new role to assassinate Jaime Lannister, or whether she's going to be hung.
Yeah, hanged, what is it? Noose hanged. Or sword? Or
yeah,
something
noose
like that.
Or choose between noose or sword. And we hear all we hear is that Brienne says a single word, and then later in the story she tells Jaime, "Hey, I got to show you something in the Riverlands," and then that's where we leave her. So, if I recall correctly, Caitlin says, when Brienne pledged her sword, there was a caveat in the oath where Caitlin said she swore to never ask of Brienne anything that went against her honor, at the same time that Brienne swore never to dishonor Cat. I like to think that the choice Lady Stoneheart gives Brienne doesn't have a correct answer or any honorable solution. By choosing sword, she would commit murder of a man she believes to be good, that would be and would be dishonorable. By choosing noose, she would never fulfill her vows to protect the girls. So I hypothesize the single word she says to Lady Stoneheart's hand is honor. Family, duty, honor, indeed, which would resonate with Catelyn, because that's her family's words. And I've...
Yeah.
That's really compelling. I've actually never personally seen it stated like that. So it's like Brienne would find a third way that would appeal to what, like the Catelyn's ghost, essentially her deepest held, like, core values.
Yeah,
I like it.
I like it too. Here's the question: how is Martin setting us up? Because this is how Martin writes. Mm-hmm. He sets you up. Right. Mm-hmm. He's gonna jab with his left like three times and then bring the right around and punch you in the face. Mm-hmm. So how is he setting us up? Is he setting us up to fall in love with the idea of Brienne and Jaime just to kind of cut us off at the knees? Or is he setting us up to make us think, okay, Brienne is clearly betraying Jaime, but you're going to have some sort of brilliant eucatastrophe at the end of this where someone saves the day?
I think clearly the reader is supposed to think, unless you're doing like double reverse, no take backs logic. I think that the reader is supposed to understand that Jamie's in real jeopardy I felt very like, oh no, when Brienne goes and approaches him at King's Landing and says, I need to show, or was it at King's Landing? Or was it actually
he's in the wilderness somewhere. He's not in the Neck. He's in the Crown Lands or something.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So he's in the Crown Lands or wherever it is. And Brienne, who has just been given this ultimatum by Lady Stoneheart, says, you got to make a choice here. And then she shows up and says, hey, I found one of the Stark girls. It's either Sansa or Arya, I forget. And you got to come with me. It's like a day's ride away. And so he leaves.
Yeah.
But we happen to know that neither Arya or Sansa is where she's claiming him to be. So she is clearly lying.
Right.
To Jaime.
I just looked it up. This happened at Pinnytree, which is a small village just north of Riverrun, so it's in the Riverlands. But,
okay, good.
But yeah, what you said is entirely right. So I think you're supposed to understand that she's Shanghaiing, which makes me think, because I do think in terms of double secret reverse no take back twists, that Martin, whatever he wants you to think, or whatever is the plain reading, is probably something different. So the question is, like, how is Brienne going to pull this off? Is she going to, like, bring Jaime before Catelyn and, like, through some sort of argument, bring Lady Stoneheart to her way of thinking?
Well, look,
I
think the world of Brienne.
Uh-huh.
I heard Martin call her Brienne-y. So I think of the world of Brienne, but she is no match for Lady Stoneheart's intellect. If she's going to try to outcraft the crafty, Catelyn Stark, I don't have a high sense of hope for that.
She'd need at least a law degree, and she does not have that. So
whatever the case is, she just lied to Jaime to trick him into coming away from his army. into the wilderness.
Which is not very Brienne type behavior.
No.
So there's, like I said, there's a lot of indications that maybe not everything's what it is. But I'm honestly pulling for some version of what Caitlin here is suggesting, because I've been a Brienne Jaime Shipper.
I want Brienne and Tormund to get together.
We're gonna have gigantic
children that will rule the North.
We're gonna have a fight on this here podcast. I see. All right. Okay. Well, you know, everyone has their fucking opinions, I guess. Let's move on to Evan.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Evan S. has a question, which is, how do they address the years in Essos? I made a mental note during my rewatch of Game of Thrones where Daenerys mentions a time frame in regards to years in Westeros. I have forgotten the exact episode, but most likely the episode in question happens in season 4. That's the problem with mental notes. Not as reliable as actual notes. I realize that Westeros tracks years in regards to Aegon's conquering. I can't imagine Aegon's conquering has any relevance to Essos outside of Westeros. I can't find anything that specifically says how they track years. Our current way of telling years is pretty much based on religious significance. I was curious if anything you came across in your research for your book would lead you to draw similarities to how Essos tracks years. This is a fantastic question.
It really is, yeah.
That, as far as I can tell, after researching it for about an hour, has no answer that has been established in any kind of canon source or fact. Which, when you think about all the questions George has been asked, this is a pretty good one. In Westeros, the Maesters count time based on, like, the 0 year is when Aegon conquered Westeros and united it. So, right. Like, we're roughly 300-ish AC after Aegon's conquering, as they count time. But why is there any? So let's now, since there is no definitive answer, let's do what we do in the book, Anthony, which is try to find precedent in the real world that Martin is basing his saga on, and see if there is any. What are the reasons? Everyone has a reason for creating a calendar, right? Every people around the world, you need a calendar to, at bare minimum, track the growth cycles so you can get your harvests planned, and you know when the migrations are going to start, and you know when things are going to get cold. You don't. So every culture kind of comes up with their own calendar.
Right. And if Martin, I mean, here would be the simple answer to Evan's question, that because Essos is a continent with lots of different ancient cultures, probably most of those different cultures or different states are going to have their own calendar.
Yeah.
So in the ancient world, you measured these things in many cases by the reign of kings. Mm-hmm. So you'd like say, well, in the third year of the reign of King Josiah or something like that.
Right.
You wouldn't say like in 21 BC.
Right.
So the answer is there would be no unified system in Essos because it has so many different cultures, right? Mm-hmm. And that would be one way to do it. You could do it by the reign of kings, or you could do it from a major event. So like, I don't know, it could be that some cultures would measure it by like the Doom of Valyria, or, I think traditionally, the Jewish calendar, like right now it's 2019 for Jews, but they know that traditionally speaking, this is the year 5779. And the reason that it's that is because this is sort of by tradition when the world was created. Mm-hmm. It was created about 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, and hey man, you'd be hard pressed to find a Jew who actually believes in young earth creationism.
Sure.
But just traditionally, we all inherit a mythology.
Remember the conversation we had about the pyramids? There's some problems with the timeline of the world beginning less than 6,000 years ago.
The pyramids are from aliens, dude.
Yeah, well, of course. That's the only way they could have gotten there so soon after creation or concurrently, as the case may be. So anyway.
So every culture is going to have a different calendar. And clearly, Martin has not given us enough detail to know what these different cultures of Essos are and how they track their tradition.
But the forces, so everyone starts with their own calendar, but like we're now living in 2019 and almost all of the world has adopted a Gregorian calendar. There are, in my research, I found there's a few holdouts, like Iran, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Nepal. At least like I'm sure everyone is familiar with the Gregorian calendar and probably to some extent uses it, but for official state purposes, they are maintaining their own calendars. And of course, as you mentioned, the Jewish calendar is still being maintained. The Chinese calendar is still being maintained. Those are just ones I can think off the top of my head. But the reason the world has gone to the Gregorian calendar is because of essentially trade. Like imagine if everyone had their different calendar and everyone's got different invoice dates. The more cultures trade, the more they start trying to synchronize languages, like coming up with language for diplomacy, a lingua franca for that, coming up with a standardized calendar, time zones. All that stuff is from a desire to have some kind of order from this chaotic system that used to be about. Now, I think you could make an argument that maybe the free cities that do a lot of trade with Westeros might actually use the Aegon conquering calendar.
Well, either that or they know of it. Like, for instance, I mean, you mentioned language. I think that's a great analog here because, let's say you are a big business person in China. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, and if you're doing any commerce with Americans, you're going to know English, you're going to know how, you're going to know how Americans date the calendar, and date years and all of that business. They're going to know about daylight savings, even though it doesn't really matter in China what daylight savings is in America. Mm-hmm. Whereas from an American perspective, we only know one dating system. We right. only speak one religion.
Right.
I mean, we only speak one language. I mean, to a certain extent, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot less bilingual people in America than there are in other places.
Sure. But I think it's interesting. The other thing that's complicated is that Essos, we think that Westeros is like the primary continent because that's where all the action's taking place. But Essos does not see it that way. Essos sees Westeros full of a bunch of backwards, stinking barbarian people.
Yeah, they're Johnny Come Latelys.
Yeah,
they're
some of these cultures are truly ancient, and also there's some cult like Slaver's Bay, for example. Like so, like if the Free Cities trade with Westeros and they have like some kind of working knowledge with their calendar, maybe they've unified a calendar for trade purposes. Like Slaver's Bay, what would be the incentive for Slaver's Bay to adopt a Westerosi calendar? Because slavery is outlawed, slave trade is outlawed in Westeros, so they are just completely shut out of that market. So I could see like Slaver's Bay being like, well, that you know, the hell with any kind of like secretarial bookkeeping work that right. has to do with Westeros, because they're like persona non grata there. So I think you could make some plausible arguments about like who shares what calendars and who's familiar with what, but it's all going to be about essentially trade or also conquest. Like if Dany was able to unite both Westeros and Essos against this common threat, I don't know. That's too far. I don't think Dany's going to rule over Essos. There's no way the end of this game is that there's some kind of worldwide government that's united under Dany and her dragons, right?
No, I doubt that. However, if you look at the history of Britain,
mm-hmm.
you've got this period of time where they master warfare on the water, right? They master what a fleet of ships and an armada looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings them an enormous amount of power for a short period of time, if we measure it by like, you know, the Chinese calendar or something like that.
Right, right.
And clearly in this last season, the addition of a fleet of 1,000 ships is a big deal. So that's going to be a big piece on the chessboard in the coming books and the coming season, I think. So yeah. I don't know. What do you do with those ships after you've defeated the White Walkers? I don't know. It could be colonization.
Hmm. Interesting. So yeah, because like that's the thing is like if you have this big muscular army and navy, the temptation's constantly to use it because otherwise it's just burning a hole in your pocket, right?
Yeah, what are you going to do with it?
So if Westeros wins the battle against the White Walkers in convincing fashion and they have like this new marital or martial culture and strong naval fleet, maybe they could cause trouble in Essos. Wouldn't that be lovely? So much for a dream of spring.
It would certainly be, you know, in keeping with our history.
It's, yeah. it's more of like, instead of a dream of spring, it's more like a dream of Warhammer 40K style eternal warfare under the God Empress Dany. Okay. Good feedbacks. So that's the podcast for this week. That's the feedback. You can send in more to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. As we mentioned, you can pre-order Volume 2 of Gods of Thrones right now on Amazon, or you can enjoy Volume 1 right now in print and ebook format by going to Amazon.com and searching for Gods of Thrones Volume 2, A. Ron Hubbard, or you can just click on the show notes here, and we got a link that'll take you right there. We'll be back next week with another preview podcast for Gods of Thrones Volume 2, and then the week after that, Jim will be back in studio joining me to break down everything about Season 8. Our predictions, what we think is going to happen, who's going to live, who's going to die, all spoiler-free speculation. That starts the week after. Man, we're just really getting excited about Game of Thrones. Can't wait for it to be back on the air, and we will see you next week. And until then, I'm Aaron. Later.